jazz is not dead. It just sucks.
Hello, you're listening to the podcast version of Deutsche Vlog, a series of interviews, conversations with scholars in the field of media studies. My name is Mark Deutsche, and I'm your host. And the music you're listening to is my band, Skinflower. Hello, welcome. Hopefully back to another episode of my Deutsche Vlog, where I interview people, professionals in the media industries, as well as media studies units and departments and schools all over the world that inform and inspire my work and my teaching. And today I have the distinct honor and privilege to sit down with two very dear colleagues and friends, Michel Rayac and Brechtje van der Haak, both from the world of documentary film. Brechtje is a documentary filmmaker, a journalist. She's been directing documentaries on an international scale since the mid-1990s, focusing specifically on technology and social change. She's made her own films, as well as for many years produced documentary films for Dutch public broadcaster VPRO, where she also was the managing director for a while. Her documentaries are shown on television, on numerous festivals around the world, and art exhibitions as well. They include Two of a Kind from 1998, White Ankle from 2002, Lagos Wide and Close in 2005, California Dreaming in 2010, Ubiquity in 2018, and many, many more. Van der Haak was one of the first, if not the first, female filmmaker to film the lives of working women in Saudi Arabia in 2006, and she was honored with the title of Media Person of the Year in the Netherlands in that year. As program director and editor-in-chief of VPRO Television in the Netherlands, she's initiated a Creative Commons distribution of films and initiated numerous new media projects and formats, including Metropolis Television, Urban Century, The Aftermath Project, and Multiple Journalism. She's the past and or present board member of numerous arts foundations, including ITFA and the Erasmus Prize, and has been a visiting professor as well at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism and the School of Creative Media at the City University of Hong Kong. Michel Rayac, my other guest, is an interactive story architect and transmedia author, head of independent production company Submarine Channel, based out of Amsterdam, and co-curator of the virtual reality section of the annual Venice International Film Festival. He's a producer and director of films, known for production credits on such films as Antichrist in 2009, Son of Rambo in 2007, and Melancholia in 2011. From 2002 and 2012, Michel was head of film acquisitions for Arte France and executive director of Arte France Cinema. In 2012, in recognition for his work, he was named Man of the Year in Film in France. And he's also been a contemporary dancer and producer of international tours of major dance companies. At the Northwest Film Center in the United States celebrated Michel Rayac in 2020 as its Cinema Unbound honoree. So Michel and Brechtje have this incredibly rich and amazing resumes of producing and directing and organizing and helping and financing and promoting documentary film, VR, new storytelling formats in their home countries, the Netherlands and France, and elsewhere in the world. Truly groundbreaking and boundary-pushing colleagues and professionals. And our conversation talks about how do you cultivate that kind of mindset and attitude? How do you remain artistic in a increasingly commercial and data-driven industry And what it takes to not just make media, but manage those who make media from their respective positions of leadership. I truly hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. And as always, it would be great if you liked and subscribed these videos or podcasts if you listen to them online, and share your thoughts and comments, please. Always looking forward to hearing from you. So, good day. Very, very, very good to see both of you. It's always, I mean, the Zoom is mixed blessing, right? It's great to see people. And afterwards, I always miss them even more because we can't touch. And I'm sure that's something we're going to be talking about today at several instances. I would love for us, Brechtje and Michel, to start with something. Well, it is interesting. I mean, both of you work in similar worlds, worlds of innovation and storytelling and documentary filmmaking, festivals, broadcast organizations, the world of the arts. I've just realized that both of you have a history in dance, but I don't think you've ever met. And that is kind of interesting, because often the story about working in the media is that you're part of a relatively small universe where everybody knows each other and is more or less in the same place. Apparently, it's still possible to then miss each other along the way. But I'm very happy to see both of you, at least in this virtual space together. I would love to get us started to talk about something that obviously applies to both of you, but is also something that is incredibly difficult to define, namely success. I mean, you've both been awarded the title of Media Person of the Year in your respective countries, in your histories, obviously making work that has been awarded and honored in different ways, and which is amazing. On the other hand, who media professionals are and what they do is often invisible to the public. I mean, we have credit roles, but then we have credit squeezing on television. And a lot of media work gets presented without any byline, without any name recognition or whatsoever. So peer recognition becomes paramount. And within that space, it's also hard to know, like, when is actually your work successful? Is that how it feels to you, whether you got to tell your story, whether your colleagues or your peers like it, whether it's, you know, attracts a lot of audiences. I mean, it's a very hard to define success or quality of work, or let's just say what good work is. So I wonder in for both of you, like, how have you, and what kind of idea of what, when is a work good, have you embraced in your careers? Like, when is a work good or successful or has quality to you? Maybe Michel, you want to get us started?
Sure. It's a very interesting question, because to me, there are different levels. I mean, a good work or satisfying work and a successful work goes in concentric circles. The first one, I mean, to me, a work is good when I feel good with it, that it reflects the original intention, and that it's a reflection of the idea, of the purpose. It's never exactly what you dreamt of, but it is close enough that you can claim it as your baby and as something that extends your personality, your taste, your vision. But it's not enough to say that it is a success. I mean, it's the core. But then it's like a ripple effect when it starts reaching other people, and the concept of sharing something you have produced is absolutely key in my mind in terms of impact, but impact in the sense of feeling that you are meeting like-minded people through the work. And the more people share the work, the more people connect with it, the more you feel that it has an impact. And it's not about legacy. It's not about leaving a trace. It's not about becoming somehow eternal through the work that will continue after you die. It's not about that for me at all. It's about the moment when you share with people. There's nothing more powerful than when someone comes up to you and say, I've seen your film, or I've done your VR experience, and I loved it for that reason, or I didn't like it for that reason, and you start a conversation. That's the moment when the work gains in relevance and impact. And that moment is absolutely key. And when I say moment, it's because to me, there's nothing else but the present. The past is always behind you, and the future is always ahead you and does not exist yet. So we don't have anything else but the present. And sharing with other people in the moment through a work of art that you have made is all we have.
Brechtje, do you recognize this, or do you see?
Yeah, I think it's very beautifully put, especially the first half. I completely agree. I wish I had, I would be able to express it as well and confidently as you do, Michelle. But I think that is totally true, that at some point, when you release the baby, you feel awkward. I mean, it's almost like motherhood or something. You have to let go, and then, but you know, it's not perfect. It's not safe out there. It's many misunderstandings are waiting, and then you don't know if it will be well received. You don't know if somebody will stretch out if it falls down or triples, and it's a scary moment, I think. And I think really truly for myself, it's only over time, sometimes with 1 or 2 years, that I really feel able to say if work was ended well, was successful in a way. And I think it has to do with what Michelle was also saying, that ripple effect, that you have a kind of feeling, you have an observation, there's a story you want to tell. In my case, usually relating to how society is changing and something that is going on. It's a combination of images, of things you have read, you have seen, you have heard, you feel. Then you tell your story, and then sometimes, it's not really understood, or people take it a totally different way than you intended it to be. And it can be very successful in that way, but you feel alone because the story you wanted to tell, the feeling you wanted to express is not picked up. It doesn't translate, it doesn't communicate that way. And that is sometimes when I feel the worst, when something is doing very well commercially, let's say, or audience-wise, numbers-wise, but I feel they are going into like the wrong part of the story. I try to say something complex and it becomes simple. And because it's simple, it works commercially. So that is, it's difficult. Now I have a new documentary about NFTs. And it's a very new subject. And it's difficult to not go into the story of money and people making money, artists making huge amounts of money. So that's the kind of starting point that, you know, everybody will be interested because, you know, everybody's interested in money always. But I want to talk about something else, like a world behind that. And then I'm not sure I finished the piece, but if what the response will be, how the impact is, how it's read, how it's received. So you never know. And you can be very lonely at night in bed when it goes wrong.
Hey, Michelle, do you want to talk about that kind of lonely?
Yes. I have a very precise example. In 2015, one of my very first VR works as a director was selected in the official section of Sundance. In the US. So I was there, and then I was anxiously waiting for the first moment when when it would be seen. And to me, it was quite a bold piece. It's a naked performance by 7 performers. And to me, it's a choreography and it's a tantric poem. So it's very explicit sexually, but it's really about closeness. and intimacy. And when the piece was started being shown, within 2 hours at Sundance, the word of mouth was, "Have you seen the orgy piece?" And so, yeah. so it was very, and I completely understood. And I learned something in that moment. I said, when like you said, Brescia, so right. When you release the baby, when you leave it on its own, you know, to be eaten alive by the audience, you have to accept that it's no longer yours, and it becomes the audience's perception. So from that moment on, I've learned that you cannot keep control and ownership of a work once it's released. And it can be very frustrating and very lonely, yes, but also sometimes very rewarding. I did a live event in the 90s that was extremely successful, called Le Bal Moderne in Paris, the modern ball, where the choreographies were performed by the audience. And in those years, it was in the 90s, it was something very, very unusual to have such participatory level of audiences. Now we're more used to interactivity, you know, in live arts as well. And for years after this event, which went touring around the world for the whole decade of the 90s, but way even today, I still meet people who say, "Are you the Michel Rayac from the modern ball? If you are, I owe you my life, because that's where I met my husband. That's where I met my wife. That's where my life changed. And I was there every night." And it is so, so incredibly rewarding when you realize that what you've done has had an impact on people's lives.
Yeah, I agree with you. And what you said earlier, that it's really in the moment where you share that you can feel the gratification or the feeling that something worked for someone.
Yeah.
It is interesting that both of you, in the way you talk about, you know, quality and good work and success, you find that ultimately it's very much about the definition that works for you, right? That how difficult it is to rely on any kind of external parameters or definitions, because like you have no control. And even when something is, I love that, Bartje, when something is commercially successful, it still doesn't mean necessarily that it's a good work. I mean, it could have been a horrible experience or
see, now with Joris Luyendijk's book, he is like the third best-selling book already for 2 weeks, I think. And he is, I think, very unhappy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very in that sense a complicated experience making media in this sense.
Yeah, but I think what Michel was saying, because I know Michel, you are an expert in VR works, that I had some experience in VR production as well, documentary VR, and I absolutely wanted to get into it very early on, because I felt that the way it could convey a sense of place and of being somewhere was very powerful and very interesting to me. But when I finished the pieces and they were shown at ITFA and different places and people were enjoying them, I really felt not satisfied because there was no sharing. Like, we could never share that experience at the same time. So this is when I felt that for me, VR was not the way to go, for now at least, because I really need that moment of connection. And I couldn't find it in VR.
I agree with you, but it's happening in a very different way. I mean, social VR, what everyone is talking about, the metaverse, you know, it's really about social VR when you are sharing experiences with other people at the same time within the frame of social platforms, you know, like VR chat, for instance. And my experience in the, let's say, last couple years has been almost entirely focused on the metaverse and on being together in VR and experiencing works, experiencing creativity together with other people. And it's very powerful, because what happens is that the exchange and the and the discussion that you start having with people who are experiencing the work, you're having it almost while you are experiencing the work. Mm. It's a completely different experience.
Yeah.
And as curator of Venice Immersive, the competition of the for VR at the Venice Biennale that I run, I see a lot of work being done. And in the past couple of years, the most exciting, most creative work is done within social VR platforms, where hundreds of people can come together and either experience work, but also make work together. And that's a very, very different experience from maybe the loneliness you have experienced in being just by yourself, closed into a world and you can't really share with anyone. I fully understand that, but I think it's changing.
And this notion, I mean, there's a really interesting, dare I say, productive tension here continuously between, you know, the isolation of you as a maker and like the story you want to tell and then having to let it go, and the isolation of the user who has his or her own unique experience with the work. But then, and then on the other hand, this collective or shared or social aspect, which of course all media have, right? I mean, the reason why we love media is because it connects us to each other, either directly by communicating or through a shared narrative, right? That we both, have you seen the latest episode of, right? That kind of, and so there's this really interesting tension. Now, both of you have this, I mean, incredible resumes and histories of not just, you know, making really amazing work, but always trying to look for something new. I mean, both of you have always kept on pushing, like, oh, let me try this. It's like a kid in a candy store kind of mentality that I've always appreciated so much about you when you've talked with our students and the way you present out in the world. Now, I can appreciate that not everybody that you work with, not everybody in the media thinks similarly. I mean, sometimes new technologies, new storytelling formats can be threatening, or they'd be weird or different, or they detract from, you know, your core skill. How do you, I mean, so I'm really interested in where do you get that enthusiasm from constantly trying on new things, not sort of, well, I'm good at this, let's just stick with that. And secondly, how do you get other people on board with you? I mean, how do you create that culture of innovation, constant innovation around you, without, you know, scaring people off? I mean, because change is both lovely and scary at the same time. Brechtje, maybe you want to give this a go?
Yeah, we just launched yesterday a huge project we've been working on for 3 years. It's called Archive of the Future. And it became bigger and bigger and bigger. And the person who introduced me said, okay, now I'm going to give the word to Brechtje, who likes to think big. And I thought, okay, I never thought about it that way, because it starts very small. You know, you just think, oh my God, we have this incredible collection of 20 years of future journalism, future affairs journalism. How interesting would it be to have all of that available and searched by through AI? That's how it starts. You know, like, I'm at home, this is what I think. How would that be? And then I call like someone I know, this incredible artist, Richard Feige. I said, listen, Richard, how cool would it be if we could do this, you know, and it could be immersive and you could be inside this collection and the AI would be doing this. And then he starts to think about it. And then he tells someone, and so like we get involved, and then we talk to the book designer, and people get enthusiastic, but they also take it away. So I think the key is not to start big, but to share early on, I think, with other people who are different from me and who can get excited about something that I throw in the air, and then catch the ball and run with it, basically. And I think I really believe in networked forms of collaboration. So I don't believe at all in bigness and big top-down projects in media. I think that you can really make huge things happen if you have networks of people who make their own production stories and interconnect as a network. And those nodes can seem like a huge project to the outsider, because you can help as a viewer or a user, you can go from node to node and enjoy and find your way. And it looks like a huge offering of stories. But it, for me, it never starts with like something big. It starts with a kind of excitement about a possibility, a story, a feeling. And then I share this and I think, imagine this. And then someone else imagined it totally different way. And I do my thing, they do their thing, but we stay connected in the process. And then we can present it together and you have a huge thing. That's true. Like, this is the book, was a book designer. Ended up like a book that has a huge QR code on the cover, but all the interviews in the book, it's not in focus, but it referred to this whole collection of 550 episodes of TV documentaries that are exploring the future since 2002. And so it's really the website and the book come together, and then there's this installation that is going deep inside computer vision, which is a whole different field, but it's all going around this collection, using it, turning it inside out. It's fascinating, but it's not something I want to make big. But sometimes I'm like, oh my God, this is getting out of hand because the communication, it's not easy to keep everyone involved and on the same level of information at some point. But yeah.
Beautiful. Michel, do you recognize this notion of networked collaborations?
Yes, totally. But I just wanted to say that referring to the first question is, I think from my own experience that you are never as good at doing something when you don't know how to do it. I've observed, like, every 10 years in my life, I've sort of changed almost identity and job, you know, working as a dancer first, then into running a dance, the Dance National Center, and then moving into theater, and then moving into film, and then into television, and then now in immersive. And I find that when I start something new that is new because, like VR, it doesn't exist yet, or new because you're new at it, you're on the tippy top of your toes all the time. And you are so focused, and you grab every opportunity for collaboration, for seeking out advice, seeking out help, and that you have to create those teams that Resha was talking about. You know, you have to create that collaboration. And you start being like a sponge, where you absorb so much all the time that you are at your best. I've always feared that moment in the work that I do when I feel comfortable. When I start feeling comfortable in what I do, and it sort of feels like it's on, you know, cruise control, and it just goes and everything's easy. You know who to call, you know what to do, you know how to solve issues. When that starts happening, I start thinking, okay, now it's time to change. Now it's time to do something else, or it's time to focus on something else, because that's when you become overly confident in what you know or what you want to do. And so it's very good to then shift and start focusing on something you don't know. That's how I have always felt. And in relationship with people who you need, or who are in more official positions, you need their money, you need their permission, you need their facility, whatever it is to produce an event. I have noticed that the way to appeal to partners like that is to appeal on a comfortable notion of change, because everyone says, oh, you know, we're cool, we're modern, we love change, we want the challenge, but they don't. They think of change as a concept that they need to embrace, but the reality of change is something completely different, because the reality of change is uncomfortable, it's risky. And most people do not like risk, and they do not like discomfort. So you need to dress the change that you want to make in such a way that you're giving your partners the comfort of feeling that they're taking a risk, but you dress it in such a way that they don't see it as a full risk, and you take on the risk of change. That may be a little bit abstract saying this, but it's I've noticed that at many times in my life, because of the way I've been working, I've been perceived as a person of change and who embraces change and who foresees the future in a way. And so people come to me and saying, oh, we need you, you know, to make this project because you're going to come up with new ideas, great ideas. And then you start working with them and you realize they think they won't change, but they're too careful and too careful to protect everything else in the system, etc. So it's a constant negotiation this way. And it doesn't always work because it is frustrating to have a vision and then you can only realize 30% of that vision because you can't be surrendered by people who fully embrace this concept of change.
Brechia, yeah, you were sort of saying yes, yeah?
Yeah, no, I would add that I agree completely, but I think that change in itself, it's never a goal for me. It's more like you sense new opportunities, yes, that are exciting and you can't help but go there. And then, yeah, when you go there, you encounter all kinds of hurdles and problems. And it turns out usually to be much more work than you ever thought it would be. But then, yeah, slowly you kind of plow through it. And then when you've gone a few meters, you look out behind you and you think, oh, I guess now I have left the territory. I'm in a new land now. And that's exciting. And that gives energy. And then you continue. But I think it's not because you want to change something, but it's not for me, but it's more like you feel that there is a better way to do something or another story waiting. And you want to go there. You want to go to that point because you know it's there, but you know there's no road. So it's more like skiing off the piste or something like that.
I think that you need to develop a particular skill of explaining, of making something new. I'm going through it right now with some new ideas on how to produce an event. And I find that I do need to spend a lot of time trying to find the words or comparisons for concepts that are new to explain them to people who are not aware of what I'm trying to do. And explaining, almost like educating people and trying to come up with words, with expressions, with comparisons that make it easier for someone to grasp a new concept. Like Brescia, you're working on NFTs. The NFTs can be a very complex concept, you know, to grasp for most people. And so how do you explain it in such a way that they can make their own opinion? How can you share on that? That's a skill that you really need to develop when you're doing new stuff.
Yeah, I think my experience for the documentary storytelling about this kind of complex new issues, because that's also part of change, I guess, where you present a new world to others by going out there and then try to report on it quite simply in a way. But I think that in this case, because I was very aware that I wasn't fully understanding it, like most people, like all the complexities of the smart contracts, the Ethereum, the Bitcoins. So I didn't want to make something like a judgment day or something where you say, okay, this is what is bad about NFTs. I choose the side of those who have been telling us that it's wrong. I didn't want to be on the side of, oh, the new world's coming. But I chose, then you need a perspective. So I chose the perspective of the artists who are getting rich of this all of a sudden and who have been, for the most part, in this field of art for a very long time, long before NFTs, long before you could sell any web art, any internet art to anyone. But they were doing it. And now all of a sudden this cash is raining on them. And so it's a very nice story because Yeah, they, in a way, they are innocent because they were already there. Only nobody ever cared. And so I think I am quite happy with that perspective, because it kind of got me off the hook for it. I'm just asking them, you know, explain to me what happened and why does it happen now? And where do you think it's going? And then I think it's a kind of simple reporting on a new world that's taking shape, as it is taking shape, not making a final judgment on the NFT situation.
So following up on that a little bit in two different directions, but first maybe the direction of I love this notion that on the one hand, with storytelling and new opportunities, it's like this notion of, yeah, you can't help but jumping in, like, oh, let's see what this is about, and not getting too comfortable, as you said, Michelle, as well. And on the other hand, if you want to get people involved with that, whether those be, you know, artists or colleagues you're working with, or people who you rely on for funding or for getting your stuff out onto a festival or a broadcast, that you sort of have to massage some people in certain ways, right? And so for me, that amounts to sort of emotional labor that you have to perform, like massaging people's emotions and feelings and make people not feel too threatened, but also tickling their creative fancy. And that is a very, like you mentioned, Michelle, that's a skill. That is something you just don't pick up, right? You can't learn it from a book. And it's not easy. And especially now that both of you, I mean, not just now, but for the last 10 years or so, both of you are not just makers, but you've come into positions of leadership in either attributed to you by others, because people come to you, or because you've become a director or responsible for a program or a festival or something like that. So you're all of a sudden in charge of managing people and creative people as well. And that kind of, you know, being the boss, I imagine can be something quite different from just, you know, making your baby, as we talked about earlier. Could you reflect a little bit on how that transition was for you, what you've learned about it, and also maybe what you've learned about yourself when you looked in the mirror one morning? It's like, okay, now I'm in charge. What am I doing? How did that work for you?
I can say that for me, it was actually the reverse. As a student, I did a master's in business administration while I was a dancer. So I had a sort of schizophrenic life where I was dancing and performing while studying, you know, and had a degree in international marketing. So very quickly, I stopped dancing because I started too late to be at the level that I wanted. So I was in New York as a dancer, and then I just said, okay, it's too late. I'm going to go into production and you know, use my education, you know, to make things happen. And I started right away. I started an independent dance studio and then a production company. And then I ran very quickly. I went back to France to run the National Center for Contemporary Dance, which was the first national organization, you know, sponsored by the state to train dancers and to produce new choreographies. So from that point, I was almost all the time in charge of major cultural institutions in dance and theater, in film. And it was the reverse for me, because it felt very natural. I loved doing it, and I was a provider. I was someone who had budgets, money to give or facility to share, and making work happen. So it actually took me years to embrace my own desire for creativity until I started making my own the first feature and documentaries and live events. And that took a greater effort for me. So I'm in the exact reverse position than the one you described. And it was much more difficult for me. It took more out of me to expose myself through my own creative work, starting at the beginning of the 90s, it was an act of courage. And I felt like undressing, you know, and it was much more, it was a bolder move for me to start my work as an artist than it was to begin running sometimes really large organizations with a lot of money in my hands, you know, to do this. And I continue to do that as a curator for the Venice Biennale, for instance. But it's, I guess, I mean, the doing both at the same time, which is what I'm doing now, works fine. I think it's all in the question of how you do it. And I think respect for the work, understanding of how an artist feels, the vulnerability that you are when you apply for something or you submit your work for a festival, that vulnerability, that fear, that nakedness that you have emotionally is something I always have in mind because I go through it myself. So I think it's a question of state of mind and respect. Mm.
Beautiful.
You talk very beautifully. Nice to listen. Well, for me, I think it's, I don't really know what to say about it. That could be interesting. But I was editor-in-chief for a while for VPRO. So that was a time I was asked to do that, to step in because it was a kind of crisis situation. So for me, that felt like a project. I guess that's why I accepted it. And because I love that VPRO, a family kind of, it's my home. I love them and they have been really good to me and I want to like battle to keep them alive in the neoliberal world. So I thought, okay, this then I guess I have to do this. But it was not my idea to be like somebody who is in meetings all day. But it worked out very well, I guess, because I had this idea of doing it as a project where I always knew I wouldn't stay there as a manager forever, but I really wanted to fix it. And we did very well. We doubled the budget and we could convince like the people at NPO level that really, you know, we had a lot of talent and creativity and new ideas. And it was definitely worthwhile. I learned a lot from it. But in the end, I am a very impatient person. And also, I need to go out and in the world and be surprised and then tell stories about it. So I have taken on other positions of, I guess, leadership on for bigger situations and projects over time. But I don't want to be in this fixed position of director of something but now I must say for Manifesta, for example, I don't know if you know the Roaming Art Biennial, I did the Palermo edition, which was an incredibly beautiful and successful event where I kind of regained my complete trust and hope and interest in visual arts and publicness for art. But this was a team of four artistic directors, two architects, actually one architect researcher, one art curator and me. And this was really a great experience. It was like a three-year thing. And more and more people were added on in the process. We were meeting once a month in Palermo and the mayor and the head of cultural affairs. He had a PhD from Goldsmith and it was really a great situation and great time in place to be for that to happen. So that gave me a lot of energy and I love doing that. But that's something that became bigger and bigger, like an oil spill, you know, like people hooking on their little networks to the big network and the network expanding and it became one big flat earth. It was really beautiful. But then now what I do is I know I need to make stories or do these things myself, then you are a little director of a team, of course, of maybe 2 to 10 people, let's say. That's the range more or less when you're directing a media project in my case. But I am a board member for some other organizations that, and I really love that too, because then I can still, have this creative discussion and learn from it and give, share my knowledge with them, like ITVA, the documentary festival, and Rijksacademy for Visual Arts in Amsterdam, and the Open Future Foundation. So that works for me.
So, in a way, in different ways, I'm just projecting here a little bit. I apologize, but I'm hearing both of you talk about the arts and the importance, the significance of the artistic process and being able to work as an artist. And Michelle, you talk about how much you respect the work and the worker, and specifically the vulnerability of somebody who puts him or herself out there, like by, whether that's by actually doing the work or performing or submitting work for validation or broadcast or funding somewhere. That is not just a simple act of I'm just doing my job, but there's more involved. We talked earlier about work as the baby. And Brechtje, like your involvement in the arts, in promoting arts on all kinds of boards, like you've mentioned, is clearly significant. I mean, your love for VPRO, in part inspired by the fact that it considers itself as a public broadcaster, as an art house, as a place where art is being cultivated and promoted and cherished. Now, this notion, this hopeful notion that you can work in the media and be an artist or create artistically relevant or interesting work or embrace that artistic identity and experience. Well, on the other hand, this is also a cutthroat business. Let's be honest here. You mentioned neoliberal, Brechtje. I mean, this is an industry that if it's not overtly commercial, it is indirectly so. Like even a publicly funded organization is constantly pushed to gain market share and to reach people and have impact and all kinds of other pressures onto
numbers, purely numbers and Excel sheets.
Numbers, Excel sheets, data. Yeah. Absolutely. I wonder what your thoughts are on how we can, on the one hand, protect or cultivate this artistic experience and process, but also perhaps are they mutually exclusive necessarily? Can you actually adopt a way of working that embraces both the notion of, you know, getting your work out there and appreciated and accepted and supported, as well as working more or less autonomously as an artist? I wonder what your experience with this is. And Michelle, I want to start with you because you were recently honored in the Northwest in the US for your work and your pioneering activities in the field. And in your acceptance speech, you made this beautiful comment about people that they shouldn't think of art as this one thing that they make, but as their own life. As a masterpiece, which I found really inspiring. So perhaps you can kick us off here.
This concept that we each only have one life to play is a very powerful one if you embrace it fully. And if you start considering that everything and anything you do contributes to the building of your life as a social sculpture. I mean, Joseph Beuys was a conceptual artist, you know, in the first half of the 20th century, and he developed this concept of social sculpture, which is so such a powerful concept, where you say a sculpture doesn't need to be manifested physically. The concept of what a sculpture is can be applied to any kind of social or individual gesture and initiative. And I really believe that whatever you do, the choices you make in your life, and they can be small choices, what kind of cheese you're going to buy to share with your friends, or what kind of film you're going to do next, it all contributes to building your life. So art, in a way, whichever art form you choose, art is just a vehicle. It's a mean to build your life, to express your life, and share it with others and make it bigger than just your own. Mm-hmm. So in reference to what you were saying, you know, if you're not a commercial artist, if you're not a pop star, if you're not, you know, making strictly commercial work, how can you make a singular vision happen? It is my experience that there are still enough places in the world where money can be secured, where means can be achieved to make that work. I was lucky that I was able to navigate my life through these institutions or platforms that helped me do contemporary art, you know, things that are not commercially driven in the first place. There are foundations. I'm working right now on a very exciting project with the Onassis Foundation in Athens, in Greece. It's one of those amazing foundations that exist in the world that have a lot of money and who are headed by a team and by a woman in particular who have a true vision, and what they want to do is contribute to advancing the world through contemporary art and through provocative visions. I was head of cinema for Arte. Arte, like VPRO, is a European cultural channel between Germany and France, and where I was able, as early as 2007, to finance very experimental interactive films that mixed internet games and traditional storytelling. And in 2007, that was really groundbreaking. I was able to support that. So there are many ways, and the Venice Biennale, where I work a lot right now, is also one of those places where contemporary expression is made possible. So it's a question of, it's almost like it's not an underground network, but it's a sort of a parallel network that makes it's possible for artists to experiment and play and then potentially break through to the commercial market. Like Reisha was explaining, you the situation of internet artists who have money raining down on them now through the NFTs. So those things can happen. But I think that there it's a question of deciding what your priorities are as an artist, and the reasons why you make art, and what the reason why you make a film. For instance, I've seen so many people in my professional life at Arte in particular, where I was financing around 30 feature films every year from all over the world. I saw so many fake directors, you know, people who want to make films because they want to be the next Coen brothers, or they want to be the next Scorsese. What their real motivation is the social status of being a director. It's not the film. It's not what they're talking about. The stories that they want to direct are steps on their way to become famous or to become recognized. That's bullshit. I mean, this is not. There's no relevance in this. So your life can only be meaningful and become this masterpiece of yours only through relevance of what you do.
I agree. I think it is quite a radical choice to make. And most people who make that choice have no choice but to do that, because that's who they are. It's maybe it's a form of autism, or I don't know. It's a kind of it's a handicap. If you're like that, you better embrace it, I think. And I think for many people, it's just too much. You know, they want to have a comfortable life, or they want to like the work-life balance. I mean, it's a nice thing, but I think, yeah, it's not always attainable, or it's not always in balance. If you really go for what is in your mind and what occupies you and you need to get it out, then sometimes there is not a very good work-life balance. Then you are working, but working is life. That's beautiful about what you say, I think, because it's not, there's no separation. So exactly. I think this is also a very neoliberal concept, that you have work and life, like which part of yourself are you giving to the economy, and where can you be like a disciplined individual that is like a, you know, working hard and then, oh, finally, oh, I had my 7.2 hour work day and now I can be myself and relax. I think that's disgusting. I mean, I want to be myself the whole day and night. So then maybe, yeah, it looks like I'm working 24 hours. That's okay with me. I mean, I want to live and work, and that is one thing for me.
I'm so glad you're saying this. I mean, this is so true. It's a kind of life you choose that where there's no difference between working and living. It's all the same.
So how do you, if I may poke both of you just a little bit.
Because I know this is Mark's thing.
No.
Because I think it is also dangerous because you can be exploited because there are no boundaries, right?
Right.
What did you want to say?
Yeah, that's pretty much what Bam. I wanted to be the autonomous critical journalist, but no. Predictable as always.
but it's really about also self-respect. I mean, the boundaries that you can set when you choose to live out your passion and break the differences between working and living, you can't lose sight of self-respect, and being exploited is of course a risk, but it's up to you to state those limits beyond which you're not going to go. I think it's manageable. It's a question, once again, of self-awareness, priorities, and, you know, and where you stand. It's always a question of personal choices.
I truly appreciate that, and there's an element here of taking responsibility and of also of who you are, like you said. I mean, if this is there, like you said, Brechtja, you know, sometimes you make this choice to do this because it isn't really a choice. This is kind of what you have to do. But how is it possible to? And I'm asking specifically both of you because of your both positions, both as makers as well as leaders in your respective industries, or you're in the same industry to some extent. How is it possible to be that much in it, right? Where the whole notion of work life becomes this like vague neoliberal concept because you embody what you're doing. How can you still take a step back to see the industry as it operates? Because I guess you need that, not just to prevent exploitation, but also to navigate that field successfully, right? If you just navigate that purely as an artist, I mean, you're bound to run up against blind walls because not everybody talks and thinks that way. So how do you keep an eye on the industry and how it moves and how it develops? And to navigate that, you know, when you need funding, when you need collaborators, when you need support and one kind or help, like you said earlier, and when can you sort of drop it all and just, you know, go with the flow and like you said, be vulnerable? Can you still do that when you're that deep in it, or is there a trick, a technique?
Rachel.
you can.
I'm afraid I operate very well in denial of this whole situation. Because it's very difficult for me to give any useful advice in this respect, I think, because also, I mean, yeah, it's not one world of production that you study and then you learn the rules. I mean, probably there are all kinds of handbooks for how you sell yourself on Insta and I don't know, and LinkedIn apparently is very important, all these things, but I'm not sure. I think I believe very much that it's very, the importance is in the kind of uniqueness or the authenticity of a certain thing you want to do, this one thing, not a world and then how you get into this world, but what is the thing you want to do and which part of that world do you need to open to be able to make it happen? And it's every time it's a different part of that world, so I think, or a different person or a different door that you need to try to open, or a different amount of funding you need to make it happen. But I think, yeah, you have to stay close to what is you want to do, what is it you want to accomplish. And if you know what it is and you only know what it is if you know why you want to do that. Then you can usually, I agree with Michelle, you can convince people quite easily, is my experience, that this needs to be done and it needs a certain amount of support or to be realized. But it's not my experience that's impossible to find financing or support for good ideas.
On my side, I mean, like you say, taking a step back, I do it through accessing information. I'm very much against now social networking as it is practiced. I think it's an incredibly toxic way of relating to yourself. So I don't do social networks at all anymore. I don't do Facebook. I think Facebook is the most toxic thing that we have in our society today. So I'm just out of that. But I use the social networks for focused groups where I get my information. And every day, I always start my day with 1 hour to 1 hour and a half of reading stuff, reading information, reading what comes through the focused WhatsApp groups that I'm on for VR in particular. Mm-hmm. And I absorb all this on a very regular basis because I need to know where we're going, the state of things, the state of technological innovations, etc., so that I am aware of my options as a maker or as a producer. And that way of feeling that I sort of keep track through this information flow, but also through access to the incredible community of people I'm a part of, makes me at peace with this notion that I do have a sort of perspective on the landscape that I operate in. And once that is done and I feel that I'm swimming in that flow of constant information, but focused information, I can do my own work either as a curator, as a producer, or as a maker. And I feel that it really goes hand in hand. But the most reassuring thing in that way is the support that I feel I can get anytime from the community. If I have a question, if I'm looking for something, I just launch the request in the groups and immediately I get info, support, help, you know, and the network is incredible that way. But it works when it is focused. In my case, around immersive arts. What I find incredibly toxic in the way social networks are being used today is the way it's become a sort of narcissistic device, generating more frustration than happiness for anyone using them. I'm really shocked, for instance, at the impact that social networks have on the way people look. I'm shocked at how young women all dress the same, all have the same makeup, all have the same way of doing their hair. It's horrible. It's really, really depressing to see the uniformization that comes from excessive use of social networks. I really, really dislike it very much. So social networking that way is toxic, but using social networks for focused agendas for focused reasons is an amazing tool.
Thanks, Michelle. I really appreciate that. I don't want to take up too much of your time. You've already been incredibly generous, as always, and I'm really grateful for that. I guess I wanted to end our conversation following up about this a little bit, and this is a question I especially get from students for professionals such as yourselves, which has to do very much also with your careers, which is the you know, what's next, what's coming up, what is the big new idea? And Brechi, you mentioned earlier your new documentary that's coming out on NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And Michelle, you talked earlier about how excited you are in recent years seeing developments in VR productions towards social VR. These, you could argue, are both elements of a discussion that is had in circles all across the media industries, as well as industries outside, which unfortunately Mark Zuckerberg has colonized to some extent by renaming his company Meta, you know, to celebrate the metaverse. But I mean, like both of you said, people have been working on this and doing this for a very long time now already. So within this notion of the metaverse, of this notion of all the experiences we now have with media, whether that's watching a film or attending a screening or a festival or shopping or dating or connecting or focus information seeking, like you said, Michelle, all of that being part of some kind of coherent, seamless system. While it might be utopian to some extent or dystopian, in a way it's already here, right? We're already combining information and experiences and content and all of that connections on a day-to-day basis. For you as storytellers, we're always looking for, you know, new challenges, new opportunities. Could you perhaps conclude our conversation today with talking a little bit about what is truly exciting about all of this for you? Like where do all the bells start tingling? Like, woohoo, this is great. And where do you feel, you know, I wouldn't say scared, but still have some real concerns from your specific perspective as makers in this area? And maybe Brechtje, you wanna start or Michelle?
Well, what I am very excited about, what I took away from the research about the NFTs, is other parts of the world taking over and really rising a global, a more or flatter Earth, let's say. I think the one thing that stuck with me is this guy. His name is Veritas. He's working for Metaverse. He acquires NFTs for a company based in India. And he said, look, you have to realize that just like people in my country skipped the fixed line phone to a mobile phone, they skipped having a bank account and they went straight into crypto. So this allows us to stay home and to make money and to participate in this crypto sphere, get rich and produce our stories and our artworks. And now we can be patrons of the art. Now it's our turn. And that's something that I hadn't really realized, that at least this is one of the parts, options, new aspects that crypto and NFTs are bringing us, not so much us in Europe, but bringing them in India, in Bangladesh, in the Philippines, in Indonesia. So I think that's very exciting. I think that in a way there is a kind of redistribution going on. The problem is, and that really scares me, it also means that there is a kind of deconstruction going on of the systems that we built. The banks, I'm not so worried about. The art world was already pretty rotten, if you ask me. So I don't worry about these institutions losing some of their power and influence, but I think democracy, the idea that we run a project together and that we all have a voice and a vote, this is something what the crypto people also say, is decentralized. But I think they are going for decentralizing by breaking down the institutions that we have. And I think democracy is also a pretty good way, if it works, of decentralizing and to really redistribute power. So I think this I'm really worried about, that in the move towards a money-driven, value-driven, crypto-driven restructuring of economies, we are losing democratic systems that are not so easy to get back once they lose, I think, once we lose them. That's what worries me.
I find this very, very relevant. I agree with that. On my side, I have A part of my life is spent in Africa. I was brought up in Africa, and I have a house in Kenya where I go, you know, very regularly, and where I'm very involved with the Swahili culture there. And what I observe is that there's an incredible rise of African creativity and recognition and understanding of the new ways of expression. So I'm in the same way that Brescia had this experience with an Indian crypto specialist, I'm seeing an explosion of talent and truly original creativity in all over Africa, which I find very exciting for the future, including in digital media and VR.
Yeah, I agree.
So this is something I'm very excited about, and I'm doing my best, you know, to try and support that and be a part of that. As far as immersive media go, I'm really excited about how VR and immersive media can be developed as an extension of real life, of physical life, and not as an escape. The one thing that worries me is that if games are going to be the main reason why people go into VR, I worry that the escapism that represents will grow, and games in VR can be so incredibly sophisticated and so incredibly engaging that when you start spending time in those game worlds in VR, it's really, really difficult to go back to real life, because real life looks so dull and so boring, you know, compared to the time you spend in VR. Look at the addiction, you know, that games represent already with flat screens. You can very easily imagine how much more addictive it is when you are in full 360 and interactivity around you. So if immersive media become more and more an escape from reality, then I worry. But I'm seeing that in a parallel way, there are more and more ways of approaching immersive as an extension, as a way of enriching physical life. And this is what I want to focus on. I want, in everything I do, I want to focus on how relevant is it to extend, enrich, augment the physical reality with an immersive dimension. And it needs to be consistent. The two together need to make sense and need to feed each other. In the example of communication, for instance, is one of the best. I mean, when you can communicate, when you can replace a Zoom meeting like we have right now as something in presence, you know, through avatars that will feel and look more and more like our real selves or complete fantasies of ourselves, it's much more engaging and much more exciting to be with people, you know, when you can be physically, you have the illusion of being physically present. There are many, many ways that VR is going to provide those opportunities of an enriched sense of presence. And that's what I think I'm most excited about.
Mm. Thanks. There's so much more that we could talk about, but I'm not going to demand any more time from you. I hope we'll see each other again and with students in a real room and having perhaps a little bit more organic, like you said. This is an extension, not a replacement of what we do in the classroom. But for now, just thank you so much for your time and your vision and your work. It's truly inspiring. So thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great to meet you, Michel.
Same here, Brescia.